I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jeff Turner joins me now. He is the host of a new CBC radio program on drugs. It debuts Tuesday, the 27th of June on CBC Radio 1. That will be available on the CBC's site as a podcast. Mr. Turner will tell us about this program that looks at our relationship to drugs, the ones we need and the ones that a lot of people are addicted to, and our attitudes towards drugs culturally, politically, and emotionally. They'll also look at some of the science as well. Jeff Turner was most recently a producer on The 180, which ended this past weekend. He's been with the CBC since 2010 as a producer of Current Affairs Radio. Before that, he worked in film and television. His Twitter handle is @Jeff_Turner. Visit cbc.ca/ondrugs for more. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jeff Turner. Mr. Turner, good morning.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So this show looks at the implications of drugs. I mentioned in the introduction science, culture, politics, and emotional, our reaction to it emotionally. Why was it important for you to, not important, but why did you think at this time it was necessary to do a show on drugs?
I don't think this is just a situation for Canada, but especially in Canada right now, it feels like it's a real crossroads moment in the history of our relationship with drugs. So we've got legislation coming through on marijuana legalization. We've got an opioid crisis that's especially intense in Vancouver right now, but is rolling across the country. There's kind of a time of reckoning, it feels like, where we have to really think deeply about our relationship with drugs, how we shape policy around that, how we live with drugs. And I guess with all those things in mind, I approached the network with a pitch, and they seem to agree.
And it's a complicated relationship that we have with drugs, isn't it? Because there are a lot of drugs that we take that are of benefit to us that we need. And then there are people that are addicted, and those are sometimes the same people, right?
Yeah, and even a word like need can be a very complicated and problematizing way of thinking about it. Mm. Because absolutely someone needs antibiotics when they're suffering from some kind of infection, but there are people who feel they need opioids not to fix physical pain, but to actually feel normal. I've had dozens of conversations the last few weeks with people struggling specifically with opioid addictions, and I hear that all the time, that it's not, for many of them, it's less about what the feeling the drug gives to them than it is about some of the feelings that it takes away.
So are all drugs created equal then? Or viewed equally in our society, in our culture?
No, and that's another peculiar dimension of the conversations that we tend to have around drugs. There are the drugs that we have sanctioned to whatever degree. Obviously, alcohol is the big recreational drug in our society. And there are drugs that, for all sorts of cultural and historical and even religious and mythological reasons, have historically fallen outside the bounds of that we don't sanction, opioids among those.
Well, so one of the things that I've listened to a little bit of the show, a little bit of one show and a little bit of another show, is that my guess is, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, when you do a show like this, you want to start a conversation about drugs. And did you feel that if we don't talk about it, I mean, that is obviously to our detriment if we don't talk about something that's such a part of our society today. That's a problem for a lot of people, right?
Yeah, and when it comes to drugs, we seem to have a kind of funny way of approaching the conversation. I think in one of the episodes I referred to it, it's either moralizing on the one hand, or it's kind of Cheech and Chong on the other end, mm-hmm. where we're either laughing and joking about it, or we're treating it as a problem right out of the gates instead of a really kind of frank conversation about why we do drugs, instead of starting from a point where it's always a problem, thinking about drugs in a more open way, about the ways they benefit us and the ways they harm us.
I mean, we are quite prudish about drugs, aren't we?
Yeah, I think maybe we're starting to be less so. I think it's really interesting, actually. You see a shift, and there are a lot of ways of thinking about why it's happening this way. But I even see it with the way the current opioid epidemic is being covered, not just here, but in the United States. It seems to me, well, and we found some archival tape from CBC in the 1950s, and there's a stark contrast in the tone of the way people talked about addiction at that time and the way people talk about it now, which I think tends to be a lot more sympathetic now than it was in the past, where we're a lot more willing to embrace the idea that to the extent that addiction is a problem in our society, it's a problem around, it's a health problem. It's mm-hmm. not a moral problem.
Yeah.
So I think that's starting to change.
And do you think it changed quickly here in Vancouver as opposed to, say, other parts of the country?
Yeah, and we're finding, Matthew and Rafferty, the folks who are producing this with me, we find that we have to check our assumptions sometimes and check our biases in that regard.
Because the three of you are from here. And
we're from here, and we're coming from that perspective, and it's a city where, because there's been an opioid problem in Vancouver more or less as long as there's been a Vancouver, we're maybe a little ahead of the game on some of the thinking around addiction and harm reduction and that sort of stuff, and not necessarily the case in some of the places that are being hit really hard right now. Sometimes it's a small community, and they're not as plugged into newer thinking around it.
So when we the stuff that we don't talk about drugs, I mean, and if we did, it would save lives, wouldn't it? Especially in this town.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I don't know if you know, if you're aware of Bruce Alexander, a retired psychology professor at SFU, and he did some really pioneering work around addiction. We feature him in one of our later episodes. And he did a pioneering experiment in the 1970s with his colleagues where what they did is they challenged one of the basic assumptions around addiction, which was partly based on some experiments with rats, where rats were placed in what's called a Skinner box. It's named for the behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner. And they were given an opportunity to administer heroin to themselves. All they had to do was press a lever.
And then would be given to them.
It would be given to them. And what they found is in this restrictive environment, given the opportunity, these solitary rats would eventually take heroin until they died.
Mm.
And from that, psychologists had extrapolated and transferred that thinking to humans as proof that the problem lay in the heroin, that something chemically happened in the brain of those rats in their relationship to the opiate that made them unable to control themselves to the point that they wanted that feeling so much that they killed themselves.
Mm.
Well, what Bruce Alexander and his colleagues did is they challenged that, and they said, well, have you ever thought about what it's like to live in a Skinner box for a rat? Yeah. What if we create an environment where they get to be with other rats, and it's something more like a natural environment for rats? They did that, and they called it Rat Park. And lo and behold, they found the rats, they would sometimes take the heroin and sometimes they wouldn't, but they didn't they tended not to take it to the extent that the solitary rats did. This led him down a path with a lot of human research that led him away from the thinking that the problem is the chemistry in the drug and towards thinking that it's got a lot more to do with really complicated social, personal, psychological factors. And so that's just an example of how the conversation has shifted in many ways.
And compared to other parts of the world, I guess we are pretty much more open-minded, aren't we, than say, places in the United States?
Yeah, and I think changing is the thinking is changing in a lot of places. I think there's a big acknowledgement, for example, that the really punitive approach of the war on drugs in the United States had some really dramatic, unfortunate consequences, especially on certain communities, racialized communities especially. But I don't know that we're necessarily at the forefront either. For example, there's a clinic now in Vancouver run by Providence Healthcare that's actually doing a pilot program around they offer pharmaceutical grade heroin in a clinical setting to long-term addicts, and they've been doing that in Britain for a long time in some places. Portugal has made dramatic changes. I think about 10 years ago they essentially decriminalized heroin and have shown dramatic results from that. So I think there's generally, it's happening at different rates in different places, but I think broadly there's a thinking that we need to move beyond a criminal model of dealing with addiction.
So thinking about it in a criminal way, in a moral way, do you think that'll ever stop?
I doubt it. I think that stuff lasts. It's deeply ingrained in cultures, and it can be related to religious ideas. I think it can be hard for people not to see it as a moral failing when you see the dramatic effects of addiction, where people abandoning children or not pulling their weight in society in whatever way, not showing up for work, and it's all related to the drugs. I think it's very easy for people to make that a moral thing, that there's some moral weakness in this person that led them to that. So I think it'll be a long time before that disappears completely.
Do you look at race and class and how those blinders, say, affect how people think about drugs?
Absolutely, yeah. We've got a whole episode on race where we try to make it's kind of a hodgepodge of history, where we talk about, for example, the history in Vancouver, where Canada's first real drug law, the Opium Act of 1908, actually happened because of race riots that happened in Vancouver, where essentially a racist white supremacist mob charged through Chinatown, busting up storefronts. In the aftermath of that, Mackenzie King came out here, who was Deputy Minister of Labor at the time. I believe that was his post. I'll have to check that. But he came out on, they were doing an inquiry into the incident to see what went wrong. In the course of that inquiry, he started hearing from a lot of moral reformers about the problem of opium dens in Chinatown. So weirdly, this racist incident, completely unrelated to drugs, became associated with all this thinking about the Chinese opium problem and how the fears of white women being lured into slavery and prostitution, all connected to that. So some really weird racist thinking went into the drafting of what became the Opium Act of 1908, Canada's first drug law. And of course, then you can look at attitudes about First Nations, Indigenous people, and alcohol. The history of the crack epidemic in the United States, and how unequally that was punished. So there are fascinating dimensions around race and class.
You spoke a moment ago about the science that you've had a look at, and I'm sure you do a lot of that in the course of putting a show like this together. Key also to this show from what I know of it so far is the anecdotes, the personal anecdotes, not only from yourself, but from other people. The woman named, what was her name, Lori, in Vancouver, that you talked to at length.
Yeah.
That she'll be featured in a couple episodes, at least, my understanding is.
Yeah, so I guess there are a couple of parts to that. One of the things that I really wanted to do with this show was try to personalize it to some extent, to put myself in it, maybe to a greater degree than you might normally hear on the CBC, where I can share some personal experience, not all necessarily my own with drugs, but with people I've known and situations I've seen, to help connect it in that way. Because it always seemed to me that the public conversations around drugs, at least in media, tend to have this arm's length quality, where we're talking about something that's outside us, or it's a problem for someone else, or it's an experience of someone else. And I wanted to help, and hopefully it's successful, to help make it relatable in that way to listeners, to say, hey, these are things that I've known and experienced, and this is how they connect to this, and I hope that connects to the listener in some way as well. Maybe they can hear a little bit of what I experienced in what I'm describing.
And what you talk about in terms of your own experiences is in a previous life, well, I don't know, maybe you're still a musician, but when in your younger days.
A hack.
Yeah. But you were part of a band here, right? Is
yep.
that right? And
yep.
so this was in the 80s, and there were drugs in the music scene in this town.
Absolutely.
So what, I mean, does that, your own personal experience, does that give you insight as to where we are today and what Vancouver was like then? And
I hope so. You know, just full disclosure, I'm not a drug scientist. I'm not an addiction specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have special authority. But I do have personal experience that I think, I hope it helps listeners follow my path of curiosity, which is the main thing that I try to do in producing, is to pursue curiosity wherever it leads me. Sometimes that might sound like tangents, and it won't necessarily be what people imagine as the most direct narrative through a subject, but I hope at least by bringing personal anecdotes into it that it makes it somehow relatable to mm-hmm. people.
I was just drinking water out of my Nixon mug.
Oh, there you go.
And I was just thinking, when you talk about the personal aspects of thinking about drugs, what about the personal aspects of say, lawmakers like Nixon, in terms of their own personal relationship to drugs and how they shape policy? I mean, do you look into something like that in your show?
Yeah, and that's very hard to plumb. It's hard to know what the motivations of people are at different times and places. Sometimes I think, and this was certainly the case with the war on drugs, which in the way we understand it today, Nixon was the first person to really use that phrase
in the 70s, right?
Yeah, in the early 70s, and. In the podcast version of our episode on war, we get into that a bit about how the Nixon administration seized upon reports of drug use among American GIs in Vietnam. They drummed up fears about those veterans coming home and wreaking havoc on the streets of America as a way of propping up that policy of a war on drugs, which in itself has all these complicated layers mm-hmm. that relate to political strategy and not necessarily any actual science or belief around drugs. But I guess suffice to say that the tendency has been to create an otherness about who's using drugs and why they're using it. So if it's a predominantly white political establishment of the Republican pushing
mm-hmm.
a policy, maybe the otherness is from black or Latino communities, and the drugs become associated with those communities.
I guess the other thing that I was thinking about is in terms of changes and with our attitudes. I mean, do you think a generation further, the next generation, say, will react to drugs a little bit differently than, say, today? I mean, we see in Ottawa, Mr. Trudeau, and he's of a different demographic than Mr. Harper. One assumes, just looking at their ages or their backgrounds, that's why you're seeing a sort of liberalization of marijuana, because it's these are two different guys from two different times and places. One wonders, say, a guy younger than Trudeau, I'm not talking about Andrew Scheer per se, but, you know, someone younger, you know, the next prime minister, say, if the progression is what it is, what it seems to be, that there'll be a change in terms of how Canadians at least look at drugs.
Yeah, I'm sometimes puzzled that it doesn't change more quickly than it does. And if you look at the history in Canada, for example, Joe Clark, the Joe Clark government was actually poised to table some form of decriminalization of marijuana, and it got scuttled for various reasons. So there can be a funny sort of ebb and flow of thinking around these things. But I think in general, probably the tendency will be over time for the thinking to change in that way, that Prime Minister Trudeau has the luxury of introducing marijuana legislation to a population that's probably much more comfortable with the notion than the population was even in 1980 or whatever it was that Joe Clark first...
Even the 90s. I remember in this neighborhood where we're sitting in today, there was a grow-op in one of the houses across the street. And I remember, you know, how freaked out people were.
Mm-hmm.
That organized crime, if you will, was in the neighborhood. But, I mean, you know, 5-10 years later, you've got hydroponic shops opening, you know, all over the place. So I have felt the change just in this town or
absolutely.
In my neighborhood, if you will.
Absolutely, yeah.
You also look at how we react to drugs and our belief in drugs through culture, through popular culture. And I guess music is the best way to look at how drugs has, been affected by musicians themselves and drugs. And I'm assuming, from what I've heard, there's a show that you do on how hip-hop and how that's reflected, say, crack and Charlie Parker and heroin in the 50s and 60s. The connection between drugs and creativity, I mean, that's something that fascinates me. Do you have any conclusions as to what kind of art comes out of drugs, say?
That's a tough one. The conclusions part is really challenging when it comes to drugs, because on the one level, you can look at it and say, there's got to be some relationship there, because why is it that generation after generation we see musicians, artists, creative people seemingly having more involvement in drug culture than your average person? So why is that? And I guess that would naturally lead you to think that the drugs play some fundamental role in the creative process. But I think my sense is that might actually be backwards. From the people that I spoke to, the people that I heard from, we have a little bit of a clip of our interview with the jazz legend Sonny Rollins, and he talks about his own relationship with heroin. And he talks about how back in the years, in the 50s, when he was just getting started, he was in this environment where his cohort was people like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and John Coltrane, these incredible musical geniuses. And he said, these are all people who are pushing the boundaries of their art. They're pushing for new experiences. And it's almost as though the drugs were an opportunity to try to explore something that took them beyond the limits of where they were at. But I'm not sure, and he's a little hedgy about it too. I'm not sure that they actually got them to those places. It was more that these are people who are demanding so much of themselves creatively that they'll look for any possibility of stretching beyond the limits of their own mind. Now, whether they actually succeeded with that or not, that's debatable. It's hard to know whether the full greatness of John Coltrane was only realized because of his experience with heroin, or that's debatable. But my sense from the artists that I talk to and the history is more that they're challenging themselves. And if this is something that'll get them to a new dimension, they'll try that.
Yeah, and you talked, I forget the name of the fellow now, who you talked about Public Enemy and their music and how you cite in particular one song that
Night of the Living Bassheads.
I'm not a hip-hop fan, so you appreciate you filling in the title. That's how crack sounds.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of the conversation,
and then,
too.
And to interrupt you, Parker, the one snippet of a song. I mean, you talk about...
Yeah, Charlie Parker's legendary recording of Loverman.
Yeah, so is that how heroin sounds?
According to his peers, who were also really experienced drug users, many of them said when they heard that record, a record that was recorded in the depths of dope sickness for him, he was in withdrawal, needed to perform. Apparently, he was actually being propped up by someone while he was recording that solo. But some of his peers who heard that for the first time instantly recognized in his performance the despair of dope sickness, which is kind of a fascinating thing to contemplate, and deeply sad too.
As someone who performs music, do you think you understand what, say, a guy like Parker, how he does his music under the influence, if you will, a little bit more?
Yeah, I find it actually a bit puzzling, to be honest. That the last band I was in sort of the early 2000s, we played around town a bit, and we played heavy rock. And I found that even having I didn't want to have a beer before I went on stage because it diminished. I don't want to not feel nervous when I'm performing. Yeah. To me, personally, that nervousness and that intensity, I don't want to take any of the edge off that. And even having a beer would do that. I'd rather get on stage. I have to deliver something. And so that was my feeling. So I find it a bit puzzling. But I guess more in the creative side of it, yeah, I can see how drugs in an environment where you're just at home strumming your guitar and putting a song together or something, it might be conducive to that. But
like, I've always wondered writers, because I talk to writers all the time, not the ones that I've talked to, but the ones that they've admired, say, or, you know, wrote great books under, you know, drunk out of their mind.
And Stephen King. What?
Yeah. So, I mean, one wonders how, because, you know, I've lifted a few in my time, wonder how you're able to do anything.
Yeah.
Under the influence.
These are the practical questions that help sort of undermine some of the mythology around that connection of creativity, because I think in reality drugs can be very disruptive to the creative process, but there's some complicated relationship there, and some of the great towering musical geniuses we know. Louis Armstrong was a famous pothead, by all accounts throughout his life, and I don't know if it did anything to make him better.
Yeah.
But boy, if it was making him worse, then Louis Armstrong without drugs is an incredible artist.
Is it fun putting a show like this together? Because I mean, it seems like fun with all the learning that you're doing and the people that you get to talk to.
I love it. It's such a great privilege. I believe really deeply in public broadcasting and the value of it, and I feel doing a program like this is the ultimate privilege of that, where I get to put in a lot of heart and soul and hopefully bring something that's informative and fun and engaging for people who contribute their hard-earned tax dollars.
And it's 10 half hours, is it?
That's right, throughout the summer. So we air on Tuesday mornings at 9:30. It repeats Thursdays at 7:30 in the evening after As It Happens. But I really encourage people to subscribe to the podcast because
to a longer version, isn't it?
Longer version, yeah. Maybe a little bit more swearing, a little bit more fun.
So that takes us to just, I guess, the first week in September, 10 weeks.
That's right.
So yeah. Is there a life beyond that?
These are the eternal mysteries. I certainly hope so, and I can imagine it going beyond. But normally, with a summer series like this, they put it out there and see how people respond.
Because, I mean, you could do, the next thing could be on alcohol or on,
Every time I tell people what I'm doing...
On sugar.
They bring up another idea that could be an episode. I don't think if you really wanted to, you would ever run out of great topics for this.
And the way that you do it, and you and your colleagues, Mr. Baker and Mr. Lazenreiter, you approach these things, and I mean, I've known of your work, the three of you, over the years. You approach it from a certain perspective, I guess. And would you talk about that and the sort of conversations that you might have as you're producing a show like this?
Yeah, well, something I learned from Matthew Lazenreiter, about producing is how much latitude you can actually have with tone, that you don't have to be in this hyper-serious documentary mode all the time. That listeners are adaptable enough that we can have a very serious part of the conversation. We can have a really, and we can go to something lighter. We can explore different areas. We can have very dramatically different treatments from one segment to the next. And I hope people like that because we try really hard to take you in a lot of different places. And sometimes that means a slightly dramatized section or little snippets of pop culture and the way we use music through the show.
And you and Matthew worked together on The Invisible Hand a few years ago, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Matthew hosted that.
Will there be a song for this show?
Oh, boy. Yeah, we set the bar with that, didn't we? Matthew's genius, musical genius. I'm not going to promise it. Maybe he's got another one up his sleeve.
This is the last thing I wrote on my notes here. Love Actually, what's your problem? Because you're a detractor of the film, and I happen to like the film. I mean, I've over the years now have become, I understand the faults and frailties of the film, but I still like it.
And this is going to haunt me for the rest of my life, the fact that I debated Ian Hanna-Mansing on the radio about Love Actually. But... it's out of season, though, Joe.
Yeah, but this is the you're here in front of me right now, so I might as well ask you. How often have you seen the film? Once?
I think I've only seen it once. No, I've seen it twice. I watched it once, earnestly, because somebody had told me it was really good.
Yeah.
And did not like it at all. And then I watched it again in preparation to debate Ian.
Yeah. And so that was on the coast, 3-4 years ago now?
Yeah,
I think?
Yeah.
I still remember these things, especially. it's a film that, as you know, a lot of people like.
Yep.
And a lot of people dislike. There's no one really in the middle who says, it's okay. Do you think that explains why you dislike it so?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I there are a lot of people that I love and admire who love and admire that film,
yeah.
And it's one of those things that makes me wonder if I'm an alien, because I just can't even comprehend some of what is being passed for love in that film. It seems weird and creepy and sinister to me.
But isn't Christmas like that, though?
I don't know. Not my Christmas.
I mean, it's it's a film that you know, I understand all the weird and terrible things that happen in the film. But I mean, I still watch it every year because it for me, I don't know, it suggests Christmas in a way. Well, it's Christmas can be sad and it can be weird and it can be terrible.
This is a complicating factor of holiday films, I think, is depending on how you came to it. It seems like everybody I know has a Christmas film or a song which they love, not because of anything that you could necessarily articulate about it, but because you saw it at a time of year where there's a lot of emotion and feeling, and it got you at the right time. And even though it might be the worst song ever written, you were in the right frame when you heard it, and now it's with you forever. And it's the song carries so much with it, or the film carries so much emotion with it outside of the actual content of the thing, that it's yours for life.
Yeah, and I mean, there are Christmas movies that are better, but I this one is particularly interesting because there are actors, a lot of actors that I like in this.
Yeah, oh yeah, a lot of actors I really like too.
Yeah. So I've not convinced you otherwise, have I?
No, I'm afraid not. But it's a value to the culture because I love things that people debate in that way.
And it's a film that everyone's seen.
I'm glad it exists.
Right? Everyone's seen this film.
I think more now. Well, this is the funny thing with holiday music or films. Yeah. They have, in a way, they can have a longer life than standard programming because they get revived year after year after year.
Yeah.
Whereas you might not bring back a conventional thriller from 2004.
Yeah, like a James Bond or a
yeah, it's
a
kind
Bourne,
of stuck in time a little bit way.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure meeting you. I'm a great admirer of your work over the years, and I appreciate you coming in to do this, and I can't wait for these 10 weeks of On Drugs.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, Joe. Thanks for having me.
The cbc.ca/ondrugs is the website where you can, listen to it and download it off there. On Drugs is on Tuesdays on CBC Radio at 9:30 a.m. here in Vancouver. Jeff Turner, its host and producer, joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.